Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Parkins and Spiegel Show.
If y'all ready, give me a hell yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Driven in the air, deep right field. Get out the tape measure. Long gone. Michael Busch with his third home run. Swinging a fly ball to right. That ball is going to be a home run. Michael Busch with another home run.
High fly ball hit to deep right center field. This may go. It's gone. Another moonshot for Michael Busch. Cubs win. A 3-2 victory over the Mariners here in Seattle.
The Cubs end the ball game with a pickoff of first base to end the game. Wow.
So Cincinnati, with an 11-4 win, they sweep this three-game series over the White Sox. And the White Sox fall to 2-13.
I don't see the light of the tunnel. You know, I don't see anything get better.
Our expectations for you were low, but holy.
But right now, I want to go to Barry Rosner. Who's going to win the Masters?
Hate to say it, it's such a ridiculous answer, but if Scottie Scheffler putts, he's 10 strokes better than everyone he's playing against right now.
Now, Scottie Scheffler. People have been wondering, who is the next star in golf? And maybe they just haven't realized he was here the whole time. His stardom confirmed.
One, two, three.
And here we go. Here we go. Here we go, Jack.
Here we go, Tony.
The Parkins and Spiegel Show. Afternoons from 2 to 6 on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
It was a busy sports weekend. It's good to be back on the show. Thank you very much for hanging out with us. It is Parkins and Spiegel on the Score, but we just got the tough news that Seiya Suzuki is on the 10-day IL with a right oblique strain. It was a left oblique strain in spring training last year that had him out for 6 weeks. Oof. But in addition to that, it kind of clouded his season until he got hot in August, Spiegs, because it was like, is this the real Seiya? Is the injury lingering? Is that part of what is sapping his power? It's just, it's a really, really tough thing to come back from. Eloy, by the way, is back for the White Sox, which is good news. He's DHing and not in the outfield, though Pedro says he could play the outfield. They're just easing him back in. So good news on the South side, real bad news for the Cubs.
Absolutely. Obliques are difficult because obliques, you doubt yourself. You doubt yourself because you understandably are cautious to really let it fly, because you're worried that it's going to, you know, re-aggravate itself and you've got to deal with a long time. So, I mean, I'd be shocked if he's not just full on out and they, for what, 3 weeks, a month of just complete shutdown at this point to just give it a time, give it a chance to actually heal. And another 6 week absence is obviously completely in play. I mean, I guess it's possible that they learned something from last year, and I know it's the opposite side, but
yeah, I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, it's not like that was the first ever,
yeah,
oblique injury that a team or a Cub, like that the Cubs have sustained. But I mean,
a month. I mean, what are we looking at here?
I mean, listen, Jed will be on tomorrow. Jed will be on at 3 tomorrow, and we'll talk to him about it. But yeah, I think that you can safely say that Seiya Suzuki will not be playing for the Cubs for the next month.
It's absolutely brutal. When he has been showing you the full bloom of his offensive possibilities, making that contract look reasonable, just hitting the ball incredibly hard, racking up hits, exit velocity through the roof. This is a very tough blow for an offense that has been looking great.
And just the team. Steele, Tyone, mm-hmm. Merriweather, Seiya, already? It's April 15th.
Yeah.
It's April 15th, man.
Those are four big ones.
Those are four big ones.
Yeah.
It's your ace. it's your...
Your innings eater.
Your most expensive starting pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Your, what, second most expensive position player, right, behind Dansby? Would be Saya?
Bellinger, I think, on the year.
On the year, Bellinger, on the total value of contract.
Yeah.
Total value of contract, Saya. And then Merriweather, dependable, known piece in bullpen that is struggling.
High leverage, killer. Like, Merriweather had developed and locked himself in as you know, you liked him in the eighth, but more than you liked Neris. And that's even before Neris showed you some of the flaws that he's shown you so far. So, yeah, you've lost your dependable innings eater in the rotation, your ace in the rotation, your arguably your best offensive player in Seiya Suzuki, and your second best or best high leverage reliever in Merriweather. So it's brutal, but what you got? Here we go. Alexander Canario can hit a little bit. Time to come up and show it.
No question. I mean, it's a sport of injury. It's a marathon. It's a sport of attrition, all of that stuff. And the Cubs organization is deep. That's probably the biggest selling point of it, right? It doesn't have the most star power, doesn't have the most swing and miss stuff, doesn't have the most power naturally in the lineup in terms of things that they've accomplished at the big league level.
Mm-hmm.
The number one asset we would have said coming into the season was depth, and it's being tested very, very early. The Central is probably outperforming expectations, but the teams in front of the Cubs, it's too early to look at the standings, but just to do it anyway, are the teams that you would not expect to be able to sustain this over the full season. Certainly you wouldn't expect it with Pittsburgh. Maybe Milwaukee has more organizational health, so you believe in it a little bit more. But given all they lost and how young they are, don't really fear the teams that are in front of you, but they've obviously started very hot. So this is... tough time with a tough schedule, and you need some of these pitchers to come back because the Cubs offense is not going to be able to slug for 6 runs a game for the foreseeable future. I just hope they're still above 500 when Saya comes back. They're only 9-6.
Yeah, but, you know, with this tough stretch, they've been hanging with this very tough stretch of opponents, and they just won their first series on the road, and now you go into Arizona, and you'll have Hendricks tomorrow after you've got Ben Brown tonight, and Tyone probably on Wednesday in the day game there on getaway day. That'll be during our show. And meanwhile, Arizona has Merrill Kelly, who's very good, smart veteran pitcher who was great in the postseason last year. They've got him, and they've got Brandon Fatt on Wednesday. But they got a guy you should really be able to get to tomorrow. So you ought to be able to get to him. And Go ahead and win this. Go ahead and win this series and come back with another meatloaf and take some 2 out of 3.
Yeah. All right. There we go. That's the plan, and the other guys now need to step up. Did you enjoy, you heard it there in Alex's weekend recap open of sorts, which is a good thing to do given how much was going on. I know I love it. We were watching it as we were drinking beers and putting on tuxes before the Nick Wright wedding vow renewal ceremony, which was absolutely lovely over the weekend. We were watching the Masters. We were getting updates throughout the whole thing. But it was weird, man. I probably watched less of this Masters than any Masters in the last, like, 20 years of life because just travel, the wedding, the rehearsal, traveling back on Sunday, then Owen's T-ball first practice on Sunday afternoon. It was a very weird Masters for me. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, Saturday was really, really fun. Like, there was a ton of action on Saturday with good players, you know, there at the top, and a whole bunch of good players moving around and, like, the lead changing hands, and you're seeing new guys with Åberg and obviously Scheffler lingering, and then the front nine was really tight. I think there were four people tied after 8 holes at one point. 4 people tied at 7 under, and then Scheffler just blew everybody away. And I didn't watch a ton of the back nine after Scheffler had distanced himself, and the Cubs were having good drama in Seattle. I ended up focusing there, but. I mean, he's outrageous, isn't he? As a lover of golf, the way that you are, this is a guy who has the best irons and is one of the best drivers and is now one of the best in short games. Like, all the stats and all the measurables were all there for his complete game at this point.
Yeah, he is right now in the best stretch of golf statistically, not in terms of trophies in a trophy case, but statistically, this is the best golfer we've seen since Tiger Woods' heyday.
Yeah, so he's number one for a full calendar year, Scheffler, first time since Tiger in 2009. And I saw this, Danny, 35 appearances on some of the toughest golf courses in the world. His average score is 67.6. He has not shot around over par in 232 days, Scottie Scheffler.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous. The big thing had been putting, and he was a good putter this weekend relative to the field. It's also not fair when he chips in three times.
Yeah.
It's like if this guy is – so there's a video of Scottie Scheffler on the internet that is one of the craziest things I've ever seen. You know, they've got the – it's called like the TrackMan. It's the equivalent of the Rapsodo machine. It's what like the golf simulators have that'll show you how far you hit the ball and what your smash factor is and your launch angle and all that. Hmm. And it's Scheffler on the course, and he hits a driver, and he turns to the guy and he goes 308, and then the machine goes 308.
Oh, wow.
And then they're in the fairway and he's hitting a 5-iron and he's like 217, and he's like, yep, 217. And he's so dialed in with his clubs and his distances that he knows exactly where everyone is going based on how he hits it on feel. And this weekend, I'm not kidding, I don't think he had his A game. His distances were off. Like the around the green stuff, to your point, was better than it normally is.
Yeah.
But normally he is perfect off the tee, perfect with his irons, and his distance was a little off. It felt like the wind and the course conditions were confusing him a bit. And so he wasn't as dialed in on that stuff. And Morikawa was maybe the second best iron player in the world. And Morikawa for a while seemed more dialed in with the approaches and the conditions. But Scheffler is just so much better than everyone else that if he's doing it around the green, he's going to win these tournaments easily. And that's exactly what happened yesterday. He is, because I mean, Spieth had an incredible stretch. It just wasn't as long as this. Rahm had an incredible stretch. Wasn't as good as this relative to the rest of the field. There were a couple of guys playing really well at the time. So in terms of like relative to the field, this is the best stretch of golf that anyone has had since Tiger Woods in the early 2000s.
And he's winning as the world number one. He's winning majors as the world number one. He's the first, and only him and Tiger have won multiple majors while ranked world number one. So it's like everybody knows that he's that dude, and he's playing like that dude. It's just the level of dominance when everybody is expecting you to be that dominant shows you that for that game, which is so dominated by what is between the ears, his level of calm confidence is unbelievable to watch.
Only player in my lifetime, well, I guess I should say since I've been watching golf, since Tiger in 97, to be a 4.5-to-1 or lower favorite at the Masters, because that's what he was. He was plus 450 to win the Masters, is Tiger Woods. You're not supposed to be 4-to-1 to win a golf tournament.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? The top 50 guys make the cut plus ties.
They're all there.
And this is one of the few tournaments that isn't splintered, right? Bryson is there. DJ is there. Cam Smith is there. Like the live guys are there.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not a split tournament. This is the one that everyone gears up for. Everyone tries to win. And he went in as a plus 450 favorite, and by like midday on Saturday was plus 150. And then for the vast majority of Saturday and Sunday was even money or better to win the golf tournament.
And so I'm fascinated with that kind of mental strength when you're this good. And you wait and wonder, like, is it going to fall apart? And I don't know, but like, you know, especially in that sport where golfers try everything to stay calm and confident, to just kind of learn how to relax and just do their best and not add pressure to it. And this guy comes pre-built, hardwired for it because of his faith. And I find that fascinating. This is a little bit of what he had to say afterwards about how he was sitting around in the morning thinking about it and starting to feel pressured, and then he kind of got himself back in the right headspace. This is Scotty Scheffler after the win.
I was sitting around with my buddies this morning. I was a bit overwhelmed because I told him, I was like, I wish that I didn't want to win as badly as I did, or as badly as I do. I think it would make the mornings easier. But I love winning. I hate losing. I really do. And when you're here in the biggest moments, when I'm sitting there with the lead on Sunday, I really, really want to win badly. And my buddies told me this morning, you know, my victory was secure on the cross. And that's a pretty special feeling. To know that I'm secure for forever, and it doesn't matter, you know, whether or not I win this tournament or if I lose this tournament, you know, my identity is secure for forever.
So, man, and I'm not saying like everybody with faith can be that good, but when you're that good and you have that kind of faith, it seems to be sort of a life hack for golf, you know, for that mentality. And you play it a lot, Danny. It's like, how do you not? I find myself envying that calm, that calm and that sort of superpower that's in there and lets him stay that calm.
I definitely envy it in golf or anything. You know, I definitely don't have it. I definitely won't be the person to get it from faith. You're correct that there's a ton of athletes that have faith and they're not all that good. So it's not his faith that is making him good, but I do think he's awesome at golf. And he said, because someone asked him about, like, well, why do you, if golf doesn't define you, which he's made some headlines about saying before,
right?
Then how are you so, like, why do you care about winning? And he's basically like, don't get it confused. I'm extremely competitive. I hate losing and love winning. I just don't let winning and losing define me. But when I wake up on the Sunday of the Masters and I'm in contention, all I want to do is win the tournament. And that strikes me as a very interesting blend.
I completely agree, dude. How do those things live in your head together at the same time?
Right, because the guys who we know and we think about as being obsessively competitive and great, Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, they are not well-adjusted human beings. They are not balanced. You would not find many quotes from them in their playing days that would say something like, I'm not defined by winning and losing.
Yeah.
Right? Kobe kind of got there, which was what made what his post-career was going to like be very interesting and artistic and creative and collaborative.
He seemed to have found another level of psychology as opposed to just relentless winning at all costs.
But not what he played.
You know. And it was a journey.
Actually, I haven't watched the new special yet, but I saw him do it live, and I know one of the bits. Neil Brennan's like the biggest mental health advocate and proponent that you can have. You've listened. Have you watched his new special?
No, not yet.
Yeah. He's got a thing in there about mental health, and this won't spoil, but he's like, I want everyone to have good mental health, but not athletes. You know, because he's like, there's something, you got to be crazy.
Yeah. You got to be crazy, and you got to be, that's funny. I'll look forward to the bit. But here's the dude, he's 27. He's 27, and he is competitive, and he is great, but he also has this calm and this ability to put things in perspective. It's pretty remarkable, and I don't see, I mean, it seems like a superpower. It seems, for golf and a solo sport like that, it seems like a remarkable superpower. I should also say he doesn't have a single social media platform downloaded on his phone. He has all of the digital golf publications blocked on his web browser on his phone. So he can, you know, look at stuff if he wants to, but he doesn't hear anything. And he's quoted with things like saying, well, if I hear the good stuff, then that's in my head. That's not any healthier than hearing the bad stuff, and that's in my head. And that all makes sense to even just to me, right, in terms of how we deal with the social profile and everything. But it's amazing, and it makes you think it's got staying power unless his life explodes in some way that we don't know is lurking. You know, I Tiger's life ended up exploding. And like, oh, he's been doing that. Oh, okay. That's an interesting thing.
He still won 15 majors and 81 golf tournaments, though.
He did. How many of them after that life explosion, the psychological life explosion?
A few.
A few still. It's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
A few.
It's amazing.
Yeah. The 2019 Masters is one of the most incredible athletic accomplishments of anyone's lifetime.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Like that is one of the most insane things that any human has ever done.
Yeah. You want to know a wild golf stat that I saw today? Not necessarily a stat, but Tiger and Phil have both won a major since either Rory or Jordan Spieth won their last one.
Yeah, man, those guys are different.
They insane.
Are, that is crazy. Golf's got a lot of like shooting star players. A lot of comets. They go by really fast, burn really bright, but fizzle out.
Yeah.
I mean, forever, people tried to make Sergio Garcia and David Duvall and Ernie Els and Vijay Singh. And all great players. Some of them major winners. Most of those guys major winners.
Mm-hmm.
But they all were like, next Tiger. Who's going to be the number two, the running? And there wasn't one.
Because
a guy would come up and have a hot 14 months.
Sure.
And then something would go crazy for them between the ears. They'd lose their swing.
Something happens between the ears, even to true greatness, like Koepka, right? Koepka seemed dominant and a machine for a little while there. Then things fell off. And Spieth, as you mentioned, and I'll be fascinated to watch what is the staying power for Scheffler in this regard, because he does seem to have a remarkable psychological blend that's working for him.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And he has a real gap between him and number two, which is just very rare in that sport. So mm-hmm. he could backslide a little bit. And by the way, when those guys, I don't want to like imply that all of those guys like go crazy or have trauma or something like Tiger Woods. Golf is just
it's hard.
Golf's just real hard.
Yeah,
it's a different type of hard than a lot of the other sports. If you just get 2% worse. You go from being the number one player in the world to struggling to make cuts.
Yeah, Texter's hopping in. One says his first child is coming any day now, and obviously children can throw you for a loop in any number of ways. And another says Jack Nicklaus had a similar mentality to Scotty. That's interesting to me. I don't know where that plays. I often think of of Arnold Palmer as like the Mickelson of his generation, but I haven't thought about what Nicklaus's psychological profile would comp to in a modern golfer. So makes me want to do more research to figure out whether those kind of things are true or not.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if one kid derailed Scheffler. He seems to have it locked in pretty good. I know that was some of the narrative around Finau. Mm-hmm. Too much of a family man. You've got too many kids. Don't focus enough on the golf. But it's pretty remarkable watching someone be this dominant for so long. And someone said, you're the favorites. Which I thought was interesting. UConn in men's basketball, South Carolina, women's college basketball, Chiefs win the Super Bowl, Scheffler wins the Masters. You're the favorites.
So Nuggets? Nuggets to repeat?
That would be Nuggets to repeat. Yeah, Nuggets to repeat, and then, Dodgers World Series.
And Bears to win the division. Good talk.
And Caleb to be the number one pick in the draft. Spieth was like, you got to read this. You're going to love it. About your boy. I was like, oh, say less. It's Parkinson Spiegel on the score.
Sister Sarah Scheffler. A little fat.
Now, wait a minute.
Sean McDonough, terrific broadcaster. Syracuse University. Syntax issue.
Syntax issue. That's a kindred spirit. Do they not teach?
Fat.
Yeah, they not teach syntax at Syracuse.
He just paused, and then the shot was a little fat.
Yeah, the shot is fat.
But it sounded like he was saying that the sister was fat, so he had to correct himself.
That's unfortunate.
It was unfortunate.
Yeah, that's too bad. That's too bad when that happens.
But still pretty funny. still pretty funny.
Okay.
And that's the thing about syntax errors. Yeah, they could be downright hilarious.
Sure. I mean, unfortunately, he was a cancer survivor.
Exactly. You alerted me to something.
I did, because you love the All-Juice team.
I love the All-Juice team because I love the man who created it. the late, great Therese Paylor passed away a couple of years back now, and it really bummed me out because he was a good friend of mine in Kansas City, and we supported each other a lot professionally. Did not stay in as good as touch as we should have personally after I left, and I have great regrets about that, but him and I were around the same age. We were breaking into the Kansas City media thing together. I was the first person to ever put him on the air. He ended up rising to really high ranks. He had a Pro Football Hall of Fame vote. He made it to Yahoo Sports from the Kansas City Star. I met him when he was covering Mizzou football. But he was, by his own admission, he was not the best writer in the world. He did not get to where he got based on his ability to turn a phrase, though he was a fine writer, a good writer, just not the great. He wasn't Jeff Passan, he wasn't Dan Wetzel, like that sort of thing. He was observant, and he loved football.
And what he did for the all-juice team that Charles Robinson wrote about today of just, like, grinding tape, Danny, and then just, like, coming up, it was 22 players that he said were going to be worthwhile in the draft because of their effort, attitude, and performance.
Yes, and so this thing came about. He would always say, that guy's got juice, this guy's got juice. And so that, before he even created the all-juice team, that was just like one of his favorite adjectives for it. But then he created the all-juice team as like a draft primer. He didn't want to go by the group think that so many people do. He basically taught himself and would ask people to teach him how to grind tape, how to watch tape. And then he put together what he would call the all-juice team, offensive and defensive and special teams players that just would pop for him. You could tell that they loved ball. And those were the guys that he tried to grade out the most. And he had some incredible hits in his day. And then him and Charles Robinson did a podcast. Charles and him were very close. Charles had vowed when Therese passed at a very young age that he would keep the spirit of the all-juice team going, and it apparently came out today.
So, but of the they honor the first team that he had a decade ago. He called out 22 players, and 10 of them lasted a decade. That's insane.
That is insane.
That is absolutely insane. And 5 of them were not first-round picks. They were just deeper players that he thought had a shot, and 5 lasted a decade beyond the first round, and 5 first-rounders lasted a decade, which is amazing. So Charles Robinson has kept it going. And on the all-juice team this year, would you like to guess who is the quarterback for the all-juice team?
Caleb Williams, baby.
It is your guy. It is soon-to-be Chicago's guy, Caleb Williams.
And all right, so what do they got on him?
Because Charles Robinson is a terrific writer in his own right, and he's honoring the voice of Therese as he writes about Caleb's juice. And that is not just pedigree, that's effort, attitude, and performance. Okay? We've been waiting on and staring at Caleb Williams since his breakout true freshman season at Oklahoma, and there's little doubt that part of that overexposure has crept into his draft evaluation. As one longtime talent evaluator put it, if you aren't lazy and you watch all 3 years of his tape, he did everything and anything that any shotgun quarterback has ever done in college football, including Peyton Manning. When it comes to number one overall draft picks over the last 20 years, some evaluators put him at the top of a collection that includes Trevor Lawrence, Andrew Luck, Matthew Stafford, and Eli Manning. With an astronomically enticing blend of arm strength, playmaking ability, and sheer will to compete, he has drawn comparisons to Patrick Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers. One AFC executive said he's closer to a cross between Rodgers and Brett Favre, with the ability to be great in the pocket when he chooses to be disciplined, but also an off-the-charts gunslinging mentality to create plays whenever he chooses. We're ignoring the overexposure about his personality and worries about him playing out of structure. He carried his teams from the moment he stepped on the field as a freshman and showcased a level of creativity and competitiveness that make him a set-it-and-forget-it draft pick.
Woo! Boy!
Woof! I just love that it's not about the skills and the measurables and what people have said and the pedigree. It is a hardcore football-loving writer talking to you about effort and attitude and performance, and includes the well-sourced comps in there that ought to blow you away.
I think the things that people are looking for negatives are from people that are looking for negatives. It doesn't mean that he's perfect. It doesn't mean he's guaranteed to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. But the idea that any of this is hard, difficult, conflicting, or scary is preposterous. It is an automatic, no doubt about it, no-brainer decision that should be wildly exciting and supported by 100% of Bears fans. That's what is this? What this is. Because, by the way, people are like, oh, it's groupthink, and he's not that good. The guys that that we're talking about here, they don't bust. You might say they didn't live up to their hype and expectation. Like, Trevor Lawrence has not lived up to his hype and expectation yet. But no one would say he's a bust. Trevor Lawrence is going to make hundreds of millions of dollars and be an NFL quarterback for 15 years. Andrew Luck did not live up to all of the hype and expectations, injury and falling out of love with football.
Yeah. But no one would say bust. An architect. Wanted to be an architect, and then just wanted to. No one would say bust for either of those guys.
But that's what I'm saying. So that's the level. The guys who are like, oh, he busts. That Jamarcus Russell. Maybe you think Baker Mayfield's a bust, even though he's having a long career as a starter, just hasn't gone in a straight line and wasn't for the team that he drafted.
Well, to your point, Danny, not all of these number one overall quarterbacks are in this category that we're talking about.
But I'm saying that all of the number one quarterbacks that are in that category, none of them have ever busted. None of them. So he's not going to bust. And then you add in, he's going to a better situation than all of those other guys.
Yep.
We are talking about degrees of good and great here. I genuinely think, barring catastrophic injury, bust is off the table. It's just a question of how good. They don't get it wrong on this level of prospect. It doesn't happen. Who's the best prospect who busted? You're like, oh, Ryan Leaf is a bust. Man, he was the second pick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, who?
I mean, there. Yeah, I don't know that there's.
Who's the best graded prospect who was a number one pick?
Uh-huh. Johnny Manziel
that busted.
I don't know if he was graded that high. They just got it. It's a good question. It's a good one to throw out there, Shane. You know what this is? This is a polls position segment leading up to the draft. Is really parsing for maybe one final time all the historical data we can about number one overall quarterbacks.
Yeah, Manziel was the 22nd pick in the draft.
Oh, I forgot he was
Jamarcus Russell.
To me, that is clearly a bust, but Jamarcus Russell was a
fat man.
Yeah, and a tools guy. You know, it was like he could throw a ball from his knees through the goalpost from 60 yards away. That was the Jamarcus Russell hype.
Not a lot of value in that during an NFL game.
Correct. That's what I'm saying.
It'd be an incomplete pass.
Yeah,
it's not the goal.
Yeah. By the way, I need to apologize to all the listeners. Apparently, there were a lot of
full
them
stop
who thought I was saying the all Jews team. A lot of people thought that. So I kept
you guys
saying
that Therese Paylor came up with the all Jews.
The all Jews team. Exactly. So Sid Luckman is your quarterback. Just for the record,
Josh Rosen.
Yeah.
Julian Edelman
at wideout.
Sage Rosenfels.
Lyle Alzado is our defensive end.
We're weak at corner.
Jerry Judy.
Another quarterback. Tariq Cohen. Jay Fiedler. And they had Tariq Cohen. Can we have Tariq Cohen, please?
We got to stretch a lot of it, man, if we're actually trying to make an NFL team.
Yeah.
If we get Jerry Judy, we definitely get Tariq Cohen.
A.J. Dillon?
No.
Yeah?
No.
Yeah, A.J. Dillon's Jewish.
He converted?
Yeah, I don't know.
Good for him. Welcome. But, you know,
we need some defensive backs.
We need a lot.
We need a lot of help.
I mean, how many times can we target Edelman? You know, I mean, he's going to get exhausted.
It's true.
Julian, go out again. Can I get a blow? No. No, you cannot.
I need a matzo ball or something.
Just ridiculous.
Yeah. There's this all-Jews team that I did look up has a quarterback from the 1930s named Benny Friedman. I'm not sure that guy was Jewish. I'm not. I don't know if I buy that.
I'm going to need some season 23andMe on Benny Friedman from the 1930s.
I'm going to check that out.
What gave it away? The sideburns coming out of the helmet?
Benny
Those are called Payas, all right? Yeah, Benny Friedman. I'm pretty sure he was Irish. I'm just saying.
Was Gabe Kiremi Jewish?
Yes. Gabe Kiremi is on our offensive line.
Don't want him there, though.
I mean, we do.
We do. We don't have a lot of choices. Yeah. Yes.
Jeff Schwartz and Mitchell Schwartz.
Oh, there we go. Those guys can play.
Yeah, we got a great right tackle. Mitchell Schwartz, he's a fantastic player.
But again, that's not the team we've been talking about.
No. Juice.
It's very different. Very, very different. Glad to clarify.
L'chaim. A team in town is already pulling out a move of desperation on April 15th. Next on the score.